Hey, Tom here. Welcome to the Hack Podcast. When his dad was Prime Minister, Alex Turnbull kept his mouth shut.
Yeah, I mean, I've had strong views about this stuff for years and years and years, but sometimes it's just better to shut up and let the government make some headway if they can make headway. But on the other hand, if that ceases to be a thing, then you've got to consider alternative means.
And the alternative means is speaking out. In just a moment, he's going to name the top five craziest liberals, in his humble opinion.
What do they call them? AAA, Abbott, Andrews, Abetz, so they'd have to get some slots in that.
Alex Turnbull, uncut, constructive truth bombs or revenge? You can be the judge of that in a moment. Plus, you're going to meet the former president of a country that'll go underwater if sea levels rise dramatically.
The problems that originate from somewhere else become our problems.
The former president of Kiribati in just a moment, right here on the Hack Podcast.
Hack.
When you grow up in school, you don't learn that if you ever become homeless, you can go and see somebody that can help you out with that, you know?
Triple J.
When you see a homeless person on the street, what goes through your mind? Do you wonder how they got there? Well, getting bashed at home is one of the main reasons young people are forced to leave home. Avni Dias has got the first look at a new survey of thousands of disadvantaged young people. It helps us understand the real story behind homelessness, and hopefully that helps us solve the problem.
The day I left was actually night time. I'd just been flogged by my father, and I was like, no more, and packed my bag, walked around all night. Police even stopped me. They didn't intervene with nothing. They just let me go. You know, you think back now, like, why would you let someone at that age just keep going, walking around the streets?
Can I get a ham, cheese and toasty, please?
My name's Dale Foster and I'm 28 years old. We're at the Wayside Chapel, currently downstairs where they do the cafe. So tons of people, cafe, showers.
I'm hanging out at the Wayside Chapel in Sydney. It's a service for homeless people and it was a safe place for Dale when he was on the streets for more than 10 years.
I had really bad upbringing. Parents drank a lot, used drugs a lot, so I was put through a lot of physical and mental abuse. It wasn't a great upbringing. A lot of it I've tried to block out. I brought this up at school and stuff. I wanted to leave when I was a lot younger. No one took me seriously. It wasn't until when I was 15 that everything hit the fan, and that's when I went. Couldn't take it no more.
And it's stories like this which have created a really grim picture of what life is like as a vulnerable young person. The New South Wales Advocate for Children and Young People, which is a government position, has released a report, and Hack's been able to take the first look. His name is Andrew Johnson, and he spoke to 18,000 people under 25. 3,000 were disadvantaged.
Children and young people have something valuable to say about what would improve their own lives, what can help them transition into a better life.
Andrew's found housing is a crisis point for struggling young people, with homelessness and couch surfing on the rise and people skipping meals to pay rent, plus huge waiting lists for often dirty and dangerous emergency shelters.
I'm Owen Davis. I was 13 when I left home. Had a bit of dramas at home. There was a lot of violence at home, a lot of drug use, and after a massive fight with my mum, I was kicked out and I walked away and never looked back. The anger straight away turned into fear, you know. I'd never been so scared in my life.
And family violence is how the majority of young Australians end up on the streets, according to this report. Although there are domestic violence services around, the report's recommending creating ones that are actually for young people, because right now they don't exist.
What young people are calling for is more services specifically targeted for young people.
I think I was here with Fletch or something, wasn't I?
Both Owen and Dale grew up in regional New South Wales, and the situation's worse there. All the services are in the city. Plus, public transport's a lot harder to deal with when you've got no money and long distances to go.
I knew if once I finished school, if I needed the help that I needed, I had to, you know, come to the big city, because down in the Hunter Valley, there was literally nothing.
This research shows Dale's not alone. Bad public transport has been described as a real challenge, stopping kids in the bush getting to jobs, services and education providers. Andrew's calling for emergency ticket top-ups for young people who are struggling, more training for transit officers to deal with these situations, and for warnings to be issued instead of fines.
There's trains, there's buses, but without money, I don't know how many thousands of dollars of fines I've racked up over the years of being homeless, just getting a train somewhere because I had to go to the next refuge.
Oh, okay. They're doing a newie, aren't they?
Yeah.
Dale's chatting to a youth worker who used to hang out with him. And despite services like this existing, these guys say it's so hard to know where to go or how to find them.
When you grow up in school, you don't learn that if you ever become homeless, you can go and see somebody that can help you out with that, you know?
So perhaps the biggest recommendation in this report is for a government-funded hotline, one place for young people to go to find what services they can get and where.
It's really hard if you're going through lots of traumatic experiences. How do you know which service to go to?
Now it's up to the state government to decide what it will do with these recommendations once they get this report tomorrow.
So this song's about homelessness and the government. Homelessness is on the rise. It's taken souls, government.
Dale and Owen now live in public housing and mentor young people in the streets to make music. And they just want things to get better for the next generation who are going through the same things they did.
The government, the kingpin, wealthy paychecks.
A lot of it could have probably been prevented if people actually listened when I spoke up about what was going on in my home life. Speak out. Ask for help. Keep pushing. Just push for help and it will pay off.
Hack. Triple J.
That's Dale, who was homeless, now helping other young homeless people avoid what he went through. I'd love to hear from you. Have you been homeless? What caused it? Was family violence part of the equation? Give me a call. 1300 0555 36. 1300 055 36. All right, let's try and find out what needs to happen so that less people end up homeless and so that people that do land in that situation get out of it quicker. We've got two really interesting people in the studio. We've got Simon Burns. He was homeless. He's now an advocate for other young homeless people. He works with an organisation called the Youth Homelessness Representative Council. We also have Zoe Robinson, who works for the peak body of New South Wales for youth homelessness. Zoe, Simon, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
Really interesting to hear Dale's story there. It rang true with a lot of that research that we heard about. Simon, what was your personal experience and did some of that ring true for you?
Yeah, look, listening to Dale's story, I definitely could feel a lot of it. And I think that's something all homeless youth share. Unfortunately, a lot of our stories are not unique and they're not rare things to hear that will kind of shock us. We all kind of hear the same thing and we feel the same stuff. My story is a little bit different. So I came from a rural town, low economic household, a lot of violence, a lot of poverty over a few generations. But the biggest thing that the reason why I ended up homeless was my family were not accepting that I was homosexual. So they gave me a choice. They were like, look, you can either stop being a homo, as I like to appropriately call it, or you can leave or go to conversion therapy. So I thought the best thing to do was to leave and then ended up in Sydney.
Okay. And Zoe, we heard in Dale's story, particularly that last comment, that if people had taken him seriously when he spoke up about the violence in his family, the things would have worked out a lot better. How can we do better in that space?
I think the important thing that this report shows us and is really important for everyone to hear is that we need to listen to young people. One in six young people who present at specialist homelessness services will say that they're there because of domestic and family violence. So the services know it. It's how we then articulate that and work with young people to get that voice heard by government and by the community and by private business as well. There's a lot of assumptions that we've made about young people, about the reasons they've left home. And now that we have 3,000 young people who are telling their story, we can really hear the impact that domestic and family violence has. And we really need to take that seriously.
What's the biggest gap, do you think? I'll go to you first, Simon, in services for youth homelessness.
Well, Tom, look, that's a really loaded question. The simplest thing is there's not enough and they're not there for enough time and they're not accessible enough for young people. So we've got barriers like we've got a phone call service that's pretty much the only way to get into a refuge or access crisis accommodation that, you know, the waiting calls back can be 3 or 4 days. These young people are calling that at 2 or 3 in the morning with nothing to go, nowhere safe, nothing. And it's they don't get a person. They get a very automated kind of clinical person who goes, oh, I've got this checklist, let's do that. Then the second thing is the refuges are only on average for 3 months. So that's 3 months to get a pace, get your life together, get everything fixed before you're out on the street, you know, let alone any transitional accommodation.
Zoe, what would you change if you could change one thing about this sector?
I think the sector itself is extremely strong. I think that they're doing a lot with a very little. I think the way that we work together and the way that we come together to make this point clear is an important part. So as Simon touched on, it's not one piece of a puzzle. If you remove one piece of those puzzles, then things can collapse. So taking out medium term, taking out 24/7, it's a part of what young people need, and they're talking to that. So I think what we need to be able to do is clearly articulate the wants, clearly articulate the needs, which these young people have done, and now we need to carry that forward. We have a duty to take these voices and raise them with the powers that be.
So there was a call in that report for a national hotline that hooks you up directly with the services that are available. Sounds like a no-brainer.
That already exists, but it's not as effective as it could be.
Right.
And we know that actually having just a national call line that you can just call up and be like, hey, connect me with the service, that doesn't work for every young person. So what we actually would, I would personally like to see is varieties of things. So even a national registry of services that have a detailed description of what can young people can access, so that that young person who's sitting at that bus station at, you know, 1 or 2 in the morning, they can do something instead of just sitting there for 4 hours waiting for someone to call them back.
And I think the report, sorry, just touches on the fact that they have to retell their story over and over again. And that is traumatic for a lot of young people. So how do we actually have some system changes?
And they go back a long way too. So up to like 5 years.
Yeah. And there needs to be system changes around that.
Casey and Shepherd, and you work with youthless, homeless minors. What's the situation there and what are the biggest challenges?
Well, I think one of the massive challenges we're seeing, and I really agree with everything that's being said, but one of the challenges we're really seeing is if you are under the age of 16, the process is inherently more complex, and these young people are in violent situations from a very young age. And especially in regional Victoria, there are so few options for them to actually access supportive and involved services. And a lot of the work is done at a family level, and it can make it really hard to have that focus and that voice and that given to the young people who are in that situation.
So I take it the problem is that the people that are bashing these kids also have legal control over them.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, it's not just that physical violence that we're seeing. It's a lot of that emotional violence and that compounded trauma. And so it's not always that really physical evidence base that child protection needs to act. And, you know, they have very different standards. And so when they're there, also they're legal guardians, and a lot of the support services are through the parents for the kids. It's a very strong conflict about the best interest of the child and what you're hearing from the parents. And that specialised adolescence and child-based services just aren't present as much as they need to be.
Zoe, what do you say to that?
Casey, I think you make a really good point there. In Australia, we seem to have this view about 16-year-olds being able to live independently and that they should. You know, the Convention for the Rights of the Child talks about anyone under the age of 18 as a child. But also there is this, in terms of the system, but also the way it practically works, if you are under the age of 16 and you have fled a domestic and family violence situation, the people who hold your birth records, the people who have access to your Medicare, the people who have access to health, they are the people you've fled from. And for you to be able to get that information, to be able to have the support to how you would access that information, that is complicated in itself. And you're talking about vulnerable people who are trying to recover from trauma, then also having to manage a system that doesn't necessarily help them or aid them in that situation. And you're talking about services who are trying to, you know, because of the way that the system works, transition 16-year-olds into independence.
Casey, thanks so much for sharing your experience from Shepparton.
No worries, thank you.
And Zoe Robinson from Y Foundations, thank you so much for joining us as well. And Simon Burns, thanks for telling your story.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks so much, Tom.
On the text line, I had to move out of home when I was 17, completed year 12, crashed at a friend's place 10 weeks at a time. Daylene Ballina says, when I was young, it wasn't safe at home, so I went to a community centre for help and couldn't get any. I was one step from homelessness and would have gone anywhere to get away from the situation at home. Another listener says, I experienced a nightmare. I was very lucky that one of my high school teachers got me onto Centrelink. They were asking for my parents' signatures, but there's no way I could have gotten Dad to sign a form.
A new poll has revealed independent candidate Karen Phelps is on track to snatch the Sydney seat of Wentworth from the government.
On Triple J.
So I remember a long, long time ago, we used to have a Prime Minister called Malcolm Turnbull. Well, when he was sacked by his own party about 8 weeks ago, he announced that he would leave Parliament altogether. So this Saturday, there's a by-election for his old Sydney seat of Wentworth. And as you just heard there, polling is not looking good for the Liberal Party. And losing the seat could be a nightmare for the government because it would wipe out their tiny one-seat majority. Now, Malcolm Turnbull's son, Alex, has started going rogue, telling people not to vote for the Liberal candidate. Now, I'm going to speak to him, Alex Turnbull, in just a moment. First, Shalala Medora takes you to Wentworth to find out whether people are still fuming about Malcolm Turnbull being axed by his own party.
The seat of Wentworth in the eastern suburbs of Sydney takes in picturesque locations like Bondi Beach and Elizabeth Bay. But when I'm there, it's bucketing down with rain. Liberal candidate Dave Sharma is walking through a local optometrist and spruiking his party's credentials when it comes to appealing to young people.
You know, the Liberal Party's all about opportunities, and I was the beneficiary of those sorts of opportunities that Australia provides. People who come from all walks of life, who are from humble backgrounds, from exotic backgrounds, from low means, and you can make something of yourself in Australia.
Young people are going to be key in this by-election.
People under 65 are listening at every election to policy, and they are willing to change their vote to match what is needed.
As Labor candidate Tim Murray explains, there are a lot more young people on the electoral roll because of the same-sex marriage plebiscite.
863 or something of that order signed up for the electoral roll.
In Wentworth,
correct, which I think was the 10th largest number in the country.
All the more reason for the Liberal Party to throw everything it's got at Saturday's poll. When I'm in Wentworth, Dave Sharma's got some government heavy hitters with him, like Treasurer Josh Frydenberg.
So, Dave, I wish you all the very best here in Wentworth.
And Jobs Minister Kelly O'Dwyer.
Well, I'm out here campaigning for Dave. Take nothing for granted.
So why is Wentworth so damn important? Because losing that seat will mean the coalition loses its majority in the House of Representatives. And that could cause chaos and make it way more difficult for them to govern. They're on the ropes too. Internal Liberal Party polling leaked today found Dave Sharma trailing popular independent candidate Dr. Karen Phelps, 45% to 55% on a two-party basis.
I think that what is happening in this election is that people more than ever are actually thinking very hard about their vote. They're not just going to vote Liberal or Labor or any other party just because that's what they always did.
Dr. Phelps says the Liberals have taken Wentworth for granted.
The Liberal Party has had just an assumption that they can put anyone up in this seat as a Liberal and here's your golden ticket and off to the chocolate factory. And that's not how it's going to be this time.
Malcolm Turnbull got a huge 62% of the primary vote in 2016. So how has his knifing played out amongst voters?
It's primary issue. No shadow in my mind that Liberal won't win the next federal election, you know?
Like, the fact that we've had so many changes in leadership is quite worrying.
I like Malcolm, but I think the wrong thing was done to Abbott. I just feel that we've got the right Prime Minister now.
Like, not a huge fan, but compared to where we're at now, I think he was a better option. But it's all brought on by themselves. They just haven't listened to the people.
The right faction of the Liberal Party needs to get with the times. It can't be run, you know, by a bunch of white privileged guys, quite frankly. And, you know, the way they've treated, you know, women in general. So, I mean, I'll be taking it in consideration and I think about, you know, the likes of Karen Phelps, and I think that, you know, it'd probably be good to actually shake up the seat of Wentworth a bit.
That's exactly what the government is afraid of. Prime Minister Scott Morrison is running hard on the line that voting independent means a lack of certainty.
It's like the good old box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get when it comes to voting independent. We've seen that in this parliament too often.
Hack on Triple J.
The Prime Minister Scott Morrison talking about the by-election in Wentworth this Saturday. They desperately don't want to lose the seat. There was the Prime Minister warning you against voting for Karen Phelps, the independent candidate, who the bookies are tipping to win. Yes, big trouble for the Liberals in Wentworth. Let's get Alex Turnbull's views on that seat. He's the Prime Minister's son.
Hack. If you want to send a signal as to which way the Liberal Party is going and your displeasure with where it is going, don't vote for the Liberal Party in the Wentworth by-election.
Triple J.
That's part of a strong to very strong Facebook video that Malcolm Turnbull's son Alex posted last week. His sister's been much more visible because she lives in Sydney. Alex lives in Singapore. He's in his mid-30s. He's worked at various investment banks, including Goldman Sachs, where his dad also used to work. He now runs his own investment fund. And I spoke to him earlier today about Wentworth. Now, for you listening to the podcast, we are going to give you the full-length version of this interview. We couldn't play as much of it on the radio, but it's so interesting. We cover so many different topics. So here is the full interview. Alex Turnbull, thank you for joining us on Triple J's Hack Program.
Thanks for having me on. It's good to be in touch. Yeah,
well, a few weeks ago, most Australians had never heard of you. You were so quiet and careful during your dad's time in Parliament. You've really let loose now. What was the breaking point for you?
I think it was, look, the sort of collapse of climate policy within the government, which, of course, you know, was very closely related to my dad's ouster. I mean, I've had strong views about this stuff for years and years and years, but sometimes it's just better to shut up and let the government make some headway if they can make headway. But on the other hand, if that ceases to be a thing, then you've got to consider alternative means.
So what was it like for you watching from overseas as the Liberal Party basically ate itself and then spat your dad out?
Pretty strange. I mean, you got to sort of detach your feelings to a certain extent, right? Because politics is, you know, like sort of first grade footy. I mean, if your numbers are terrible or it's not going well, you're going to get pulled off the starting side, right?
Yeah.
But what was really weird was that they started making more of these decisions, which were, you know, strategically totally irrational. I mean, they weren't doing carefully crafted things which got them an extra, you know, 1% of the electorate and a couple of key seats. It was just sort of own the libs to lose, which is crazy.
And on a personal level, seeing the way that kind of thinking then impacted on your father, his career, his ability to make a positive impact on this country, what was that like?
Look, he got a bunch of things done. You know, I know there's lots of people who have strong feelings about the same-sex marriage plebiscite, but, you know, that was something which demonstrated to all people with crazy views that, indeed, this is a very popular thing and it should have been done. But look, you know, I feel like sort of being leader of the Liberal Party and being sane is like, bring Bruce Willis in a Die Hard movie. I mean, it's always crazy and bad, you know, but hopefully you come out and get some stuff done.
It seems like you still really care about the party, though. That's why you're speaking out so passionately, that you actually don't want this party to lose its way.
Look, I've been in Asia a while and I've seen a few one-party states, and a healthy degree of competition is entirely desirable. And if that's not in place, then that's not a good outcome for the country. So I think the Liberals need to have their act together and be viable and be competitive, because frankly, there's people in the Labor Party who are a bit nuts too. It's just that they're not, dog whistling to Nazis this particular week.
Dog whistling Nazis are strong words, and I believe you're reacting to a story that came out this week, and we reported on it, that that well-known members of far-right nationalist groups had actually worked to infiltrate the New South Wales Young Nationals. What was your reaction to that story?
I wish I could say I was more surprised, because we've seen this happen in the United States. Like, this is what's so disturbing, is the US is a lot further down this road, particularly the Republican Party, in terms of, far-right nativist infiltration, more or less completely abandoning any sort of, classical liberal sort of values. And, you know, the party's slipping that way as it currently stands. It's a real concern, because either, Australia's going to need a new party, or the Libs are going to have to pull up on the stick sooner rather than later.
Right. So, I mean, this was one example of where they tried to infiltrate the Young Nationals, and they did get some people elected to the executive. But it seems they've been able to sort this out. Do you think this problem is more widespread, that there's more extreme far-right influence on the Liberal Party or the National Party than we realise?
Well, I think that vote this week is, what more can I say? We've got a problem.
So in your video last week, you called on voters to give the Liberal Party a wake-up call in Wentworth as a way of bringing them back into line before the federal election next year. Do you actually want them to win next year's election, or do you want them to suffer more? Because if they did lose Wentworth, that would mean real trouble for the government because they have such a slim majority in the House of Reps. They'd lose that one-seat majority. It could throw them into a total chaotic spiral, which would make it almost impossible to win next year's election.
On that point, I completely disagree. If they had to compete with Karen Phelps and had to compete for the middle, and you know most Australians who are pretty sensible and normal, or for that matter, they had a Labor person sitting there like Tim Murray. But particularly for Karen Phelps, I would say, if they had to compete this for the median voter, I guess, and did not have to just constantly cut capers to entertain One Nation and the three seats in North Queensland that they seem to be completely fixated upon within the Queensland LNP, then they might be able to get their act together. And frankly, they're a reasonable government. But the way they're heading right now, it's very hard to see that happening.
Okay. Hey, I'm getting a bit of a bad signal through this phone. I don't know if you can hold it differently or something that might get your voice more clearly coming through.
Yeah, is it all right now? I'll stop walking around.
Maybe a little bit better, yeah. Right, so you think this wake-up call would work. They lose Wentworth. They have to, I guess, negotiate with more with people in the middle of the political spectrum a bit more, and they make more sensible decisions leading up to the May election next year. That's what you think could happen.
No, I think it'd be good if both parties spent more time focusing on the middle, as opposed to pandering to whoever happens to be holding them to ransom in the Senate at the time. That's clearly One Nation for the Liberal Party right now. So that's the real challenge, as I see it.
So do you want Karen Phelps or Tim Murray to win Wentworth on Saturday?
I think either would be great, but I got to say, I think voters should think very strategically about how they vote, because preference flow would suggest that if you get sort of one Sharma, two Murray, three Phelps, Sharma could win, just because preferences from Phelps will not go particularly to Labor. So I'm just saying, guys, if you want to send a message, you got to be strategic about how you do that. So I think people should really consider preferencing Karen Phelps if you're not sure, because she's not going to tear apart the government. She's not going to burn the world down. She's going to put some heat on them, where frankly a lot of Wentworth voters would like to see it.
So what do you think of the way the government's campaigning for Wentworth? Yesterday, Scott Morrison floated the controversial idea of moving our Israeli embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Do you think that was a bid just to try and win more Jewish voters in Wentworth?
I know a lot of Malaysian and Indonesian people, and there was a lot of WTF mate type text messages on my phone yesterday, and I think that's broadly reflected by the Indonesian government's position. I just Middle East politics is hard. Generally, the best approach is just trying not to offend everyone gratuitously, and I'm not sure that's been in the spirit of that policy.
What do you think of Scott Morrison?
Look, he's got the same problem my dad had. He's got some very, very crazy people to deal with, and who are not particularly rational political actors. But, he's going to be out of a job soon if he doesn't stand up to them. So, he might as well push back a little bit more, because this is not going to last very long if this keeps up.
He's opened up a few pretty destructive arguments. One was on gay kids being expelled from schools last week, and some people said he had a blind spot in that area because he's a Pentecostal Christian. He's opened up another fight with this idea of moving our Israeli embassy. Do you think he's doing a very good job? Do you think he's being a smart, sensible politician?
You can have any sort of religion you like in politics, right? And your private values are your private values. So I'm not going to say any untoward things about his religion at all. However, if you are leading a country, which is not a theocratic, one religion state, then you do have to consider what's in the benefit of everyone and what's going to work for everyone. You need to be extremely pragmatic. And I think these recent decisions are not only, in the spirit of being pragmatic and making good decisions for everyone. It just seems to be kind of reading, you know, the script you got given by News Corp or what have you.
Yeah, what do you make of the media landscape in Australia and the role of News Corp? There was a lot of commentary around the time of your father's ousting about the influence they have. How do you see it, and do you think it will change?
Look through the financial accounts, right? I mean, last I checked, most of the News Corp papers, including the Australian, lost money hand over fist. It's more a political front for the views of, you know, a very conservative New York-based billionaire who has an excellent, other parts of his media business. So it's really, it's very strange. They're very lucky they have poison pills in there so that that business cannot be run more effectively. I don't look at it that differently to a very biased think tank at all, frankly.
Wow, a biased think tank, a very biased think tank. What do you think about the fact you've said that you're very passionate, or at least, you know, have quite a bit of knowledge into the renewable energy sector. You're an energy investor. What do you think of the fact that we now have a Prime Minister who's famous for bringing a chunk of coal into the House of Representatives, a chunk of coal that was supplied by the Minerals Council?
It's a joke. I mean, everyone laughs at us, right? I mean, that's a given. And, you know, the problem is, right, is that this position on being skeptical on renewables and so forth made sense when they're a lot more expensive than existing fossil sources of power. But that's over now, and they're clinging on to this because they've tied their political identity and their political cred to something which is like, you know, the question of, you know, whether, you know, an iPhone is good or bad. I mean, if it's the most recent one, it's pretty great. If you were looking at the first iPhone, which is basically a useless brick, and, you know, for early adopter fanboys, then it wasn't so great. And this is the problem, right? If you tie your political identity to sort of questions of engineering and economics and, you know, really quite dry stuff, you're eventually going to get offsides.
So whenever the government speak about it, they just talk about energy prices. But you said in your video that energy prices don't need to be, mutually exclusive from a low emissions future.
Absolutely not. I mean, I've tweeted that yesterday, just breaking down the numbers. And I'm working with a couple of people to make this information so easily comprehensible and digestible that anyone can get it, like a sort of back of a barcode to maths. Because the problem is, I mean, guys like Angus Taylor, who spent his entire career in consulting, producing, you know, hundreds of page reports and millions of dollars with, in my general observation, not great advice. There's this whole sort of rentier class of people who, you know, provide this information in a form where you can't see the plumbing behind it, even though it's very comprehensible, and try to obscure how this stuff works, because that means they can get another consulting contract in 2 years' time when the government changes its policy again. So I'm actually focusing on open sourcing a lot of this stuff as much as humanly possible right now, because I've had it.
Right. So are you releasing that information because you think there's been a failure of politicians to communicate the economic realities of these decisions around renewable energy?
I can assure you, most of these politicians don't know what a heat rate is, right? Well, they don't understand the basic unit economics of power plants.
Well, your dad was the Prime Minister. Do you think he failed in that department to be able to explain this stuff in a clear way to bring Australians?
He had a pretty good idea, but he also had a lot of colleagues who were not interested in acquiring any knowledge in this area and yet had very strong views.
Yeah, but I guess the job of a politician is to make it simple for the public, right, so you can take them with you. Do you think your dad struggled to do that?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, you know, could have, would have, should have, right? I mean, who knows? It's sort of a, yeah, I mean, I think there's a communications problem here and something which I want to spend a little bit of time on to the extent I have any free time.
Yeah, so I guess you're making a lot of public comment around Wentworth and you're releasing some of this information about renewables. What are your plans going forward? Are you thinking of ways of maybe getting involved a bit more in this political discussion?
Maybe discussion, but not in, you know, representative political life. I think there's a, there are better roles that I can do than, you know, running for office, frankly. So I think that's where it'll be. I will be relied to be on Twitter on stuff where I have some vague area of expertise and I'm willing to share it.
A lot of our listeners were completely perplexed at the Great Barrier Reef Foundation decision, $444 million, all in one go, dumped into their account just before the end of the financial year. What did you make of that decision?
Well, it was a decision made by a treasurer who wanted to back solve for hitting a particular budget surplus or deficit number, right? So it's sort of like when a company jams a bunch of provisions into a quarter to make their numbers or smooth their profits. It's accounting chicanery. And you know, they obviously, in their desire to do that, you know, they basically went with the first person who turned up asking for a check. So yeah, that wasn't great, frankly.
Yeah. And have you spoken to your dad lately? What does he think about you finally deciding to speak out?
Look, I mean, he's dealing with it. I'm bound. Yeah, I'll just leave it at that.
He doesn't like it?
I was silent for 5 years. That was a pretty good innings. So yeah.
You gave it a good shot, trying to keep your mouth shut.
Yep.
Some of the critics are saying you're tarnishing his legacy. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, if you were, News Corp, which has its own agenda, you might say that. And frankly, a lot of his legacy is having fought a good fight against the crazy. So it really depends. I mean, if you think your legacy is just doing what you're told and being the right wing's, just being their lackey, then yeah, I probably am destroying his legacy, but that's not how I see his legacy, and that's not what I'm proud of him for.
Yeah, well, if you see his legacy as fighting the crazies in the Liberal Party to try and steer it into the sensible centre, then in a way, it sounds like you're trying to do exactly the same thing and carry on his legacy.
Yeah, I think its legacy is in the eye of the beholder, right? And you know, some people can be pretty poisonous, but you know, if these guys have plenty of cracks at breaking my will, you know, I'm not for turning on this stuff.
And you talk about the crazies in the Liberal Party. Who's your top five?
Wow.
Let's go through it. Who's first, Tony Abbott or Peter Dutton?
Hard to say, really. It's close. Those two would definitely be the top two, I would say. In terms of sort of, I tend to say Tony probably more than anyone else. He's a sort of singularly destructive human being. Peter Dutton, yeah.
Number two.
Obviously another one. Number two.
Number three?
Geez, I don't know. There's a list of 43 of them, isn't there? 45 of them? yeah, it's more... look, there's a bunch of funny people in there. And, you know, the funny thing is some of the craziest ones are in the Senate where they don't actually have to fight for marginal seats.
Would Erica Betts be in the top five?
I think you could safely say so.
Can we round out this top five? We've got one and two. Can we get three, four, and five locked in?
What do they call them? AAA, Abbott, Andrews, and Betts. So that they'd have to get some slots in there. I would say Angus Taylor, because he's someone who should be, you know, reasonably astute, numerate, well-educated, and yet he likes this stuff because God only knows.
Well, you seem to have a particular beef with him because of his relationship with the resources industry, which goes against your thinking on renewable energy.
It's not just that the resources industry, it's that in my work, I've profitably taken the other side of his very expensive consulting reports on numerous occasions, and he just has got it wrong on multiple. Like, I mean, they were telling everyone to get on gas because we weren't going to run out of it, you know, back in 2009-10 at Port Jackson Partners, and look at where we are today. Like, if you took Port Jackson Partners' reports and planned your business around it, you'd probably have to do as many rights issues as Santos did over the last 5 or 6 years, right? So I mean, it's just not that, it's not just that his ideology, it's that despite being very intelligent, he can't seem to get on the right side of events in this space, which is crazy because this is meant to be his area of expertise.
So for anyone listening, Angus Taylor is the new energy minister in the Morrison government, copying a bit of a shellacking here from Alex Turnbull. Okay, so we've got Abbott at one, we've got Dutton at two, Angus Taylor at three?
Yeah, I'd say so.
You want Kevin Andrews in there somewhere?
Oh, I guess, yeah, Andrews and about rounded out. I mean, it's really whatever.
All right, I've drawn you out on enough different bullshit. Alex Turnbull, thanks so much for speaking to us on Triple J.
Cheers. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Hack. Triple J.
That was the son of the former Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull.
Hack.
I'd like to inform the House that we have joining us in the gallery this afternoon the former President of Kiribati, His Excellency Anote Tong.
Triple J.
Now, as you heard in that interview with Alex Turnbull, it was the Liberal Party's climate policy that pushed him to speak out. Now, imagine if climate change meant your country would go underwater. That's the situation facing our next guest. Anote Tong is the former president of Kiribati, a remote Pacific island nation made up of 33 very low-lying atoll islands, the highest of which is only 2 metres above sea level. Now, this isn't just about their future. They've already lost one village. Now, as you just heard in that little bit of audio before, Anote Tong was in the Australian Parliament today, the former president of Kiribati. He was also at Melbourne's Environmental Film Festival. There's a film coming out called Anote's Ark. Now, at the film festival, he spoke to Hack reporter Joe Lauder about the climate change problem facing his country. And this is a podcast-only extended edit of this really interesting interview with Joe Lauder. Hope you enjoy it.
Anote Tong, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for giving me this opportunity to share our story.
Kiribati is often called, and I know you would have heard of this, as somewhat of a canary in the coal mine when it comes to climate change. Mm-hmm. This is a place where people are seeing and feeling firsthand the impacts of climate change. What kind of impacts are being seen in Kiribati?
We face a very serious threat, even the very real possibility, a certainty, I think, that our islands will be submerged in the future. The projections have been actually got more dire, and we may actually face those the problems much earlier. And with much more intense results.
How much sooner? When do you think you will face this future?
I think it is talk about within this century. But I think now, with the more recent update on the report, they're talking about 2030. And so that is not a long way to go. It's well within my lifetime, I think. But certainly, well before the young people now, you know, previously I always talk about my grandchildren, but I think it's going to be well within the lifetime of my children. And so that is serious because none of these countries which are being threatened are in any way ready to deal with this disaster.
Or responsible. When we talk about climate change and impacts on countries such as your own, a lot of the time the focus is on rising sea levels. Is that the main impact, or what else is it that is going to cause these lands to become inhospitable probably before they become submerged?
What we are witnessing, because I'm asked quite often by the media, you know, so do you see the sea level rise? And of course, the honest answer is no, we don't see the sea level rise. If I said that, I'd be lying. But what I can say with absolute truth is that we see things happening which damage the islands, the communities, where there's a village that's gone. There are communities whose livelihoods are now being threatened, where the sea has broken through into the freshwater pond where the food crops are grown. And so it's damaged the food crops and also contaminating the freshwater lands. And so the ability of these communities to continue to stay in their villages, it won't be very long, because what is happening is not receding, it's actually coming on. I predict that within the decade, a lot of these communities will have to vacate their villages.
Last week, as you said, we heard the IPCC released their report, and this report looked at the impact of the world of 1.5 degrees. And you were one of the world leaders at the time at Paris that pushed for this 1.5 degree target. What would 1.5 degrees look like for Kiribati? Would that put off this future that you're talking about?
I have always said that any rise in global temperature would be damaging. And so for us, whatever the outcome in Paris, we had a problem. And so this is why my focus had always been in adaptation, because what was coming is coming, whatever level of emissions we managed to achieve. And so if we get 1.5, which doesn't look like we will, as a global community, we will achieve it, then we are in serious trouble. And if we go above 1.5, then we're in serious trouble earlier than predicted. And so will other countries.
You mentioned their adaptation. What is being done now in Kiribati to hold back from what is coming? And is there a future where you will be able to build up these islands or adapt or anything like that going forward?
I don't know what's going on at the moment with the present government, but the plans that I had was looking desperately for solutions. And the solutions that I'd been looking at was the floating islands, maybe raising the islands, and I still believe that we need to do that as soon as possible, simply to prove that it's doable. But more than that, it because it's important, because at least when the next time there is a flood, a storm, people have somewhere to go to. What are our options? We can all leave, or we can try. And the preference has always been that we try to build climate resilience, so at least we have a nation of Kiribati continue to exist. But of course, it may need to be done in combination with adaptation beyond our borders. Climate migration, okay?
Anote Tong, thank you so much for joining us.
Very welcome indeed.
Hack
on Triple J.
That was Anote Tong, the former president of Kiribati. He was the president for 13 years, and he's the star of a new documentary called Anote's Ark, about the impact of climate change on his low-lying island nation of Kiribati. On the text line, Riley from Sydney says, I went to Kiribati in 2011 with school, and it was the most incredible place I've ever been to. It's heartbreaking to hear how fast it's disappearing. All right, that's it for this extended podcast. Two uncut bonus interviews for you loyal podcast listeners. Thank you so much. I'll speak to you tomorrow.